Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. Well, coming up on today's podcast, we have an interview with Michael Smith from The Snow Queen. That's now playing at the Victory Gardens Biograph Theater, and he is going to be talking to Tom Williams, so you don't want to miss this interview. Also, we have an audio review of The Snow Queen, and of course, Chicago's theater news. So sit back and relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another entwined episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of December 18th, 2006. There have been some cast changes announced for the Chicago company of Wicked. Chicago's record-breaking Wicked has announced that Dee Roscioli has already assumed the role of Elphaba full-time. Dee joined the company as a standby for Elphaba last January and has performed the role many a time. And also, as previously announced here on the news podcast, William Humans will assume the role of Dr. Dillamond. William was one of the original Broadway cast members, and he will be appearing on the Chicago stage for a limited engagement through January 14th. And also Wicked veteran and original member of the Broadway company, Derek Williams, will be returning to Chicago to play the role of Fiero. That does start on January 19th, so you have a bit of time to wait to see Williams in the role. Until then, ensemble member Brad Bass will be appearing as Fiero for a limited engagement through January 18th. And also word is abound that Steppenwolf Ensemble member K. Todd Freeman will be coming to the Chicago cast in January. He has been on the national tour of Wicked for some time, and he will certainly be welcomed back here in Chicago. For more information, click on over to the Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Also, in other Wicked news, the Chicago company of Wicked was announced as the top fundraiser for the 18th annual Gypsy of the Year competition. They raised over $175,000 for the Broadway Cares and Equity Fights AIDS Fund. On December 5th, in an awards ceremony in New York, Chicago's Wicked was announced as the top fundraiser by a production company outside of New York City. Congratulations, Chicago's Wicked. Well, last week we told you that Chicago's 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee was having a game night. Well, now they're having an adult-only night on Friday, January 12th. That's right, the Tony Award-winning and highly acclaimed musical, which is in an open run at the Drury Lane Theater, Water Tower Place, is having a mature audiences-only performance that will include a little bit of forbidden material. If you are 18 and over, this is more than likely the performance you're going to want to see because, reportedly, the cast is even having a hard time keeping a straight face. Remember, that's on Friday, January 12th. Tickets are available, and the show is an open-ended run. Well, the Trib Stage Ticker's reporting that a new non-equity production of The Buddy Holly Story will be coming to the Mercury Theater in January. The show will apparently feature Josh Solomon in the role of Buddy Holly and will be directed by the choreographer of the tour. For more information, stay tuned to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Well, thank you very much for listening to this entwined episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have now come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 2. Who so firm that cannot be seduced? Well, I can't thank you enough for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
You're listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. The Snow Queen, adapted from the story by Hans Christian Andersen. Music and lyrics by Michael Smith. Puppets and visual design by Blair Thomas and Company, and directed by Frank Galati at Victory Gardens Biograph Theater. Review by Tom Williams. When you combine a varied score of sparkling folk songs with amazing visual design and exquisite puppets, together with rich vocals, you come up with a sweet, refreshing new musical. The Snow Queen, Hans Christian Andersen's coming-of-age fairy tale, is an immortal story of innocence, love, and loss. Children 10 and up will like this show. Most of the elements of a fine musical are here, though perhaps a more sophisticated staging with added choreography could serve the show. Once Victory Gardens gets comfortable with their excellent large new space, shows like The Snow Queen will shine. I do believe that Michael Smith has produced a world-class score filled with a variety of folk styles that include ballads, patter songs, cowboy tunes, blues, marches, waltzes, polkas, and Broadway-style show tunes, just to name a few. His lyrics are witty, funny, and ironic. They tell the story deftly. The visuals and terrific puppetry from Blair Thomas enhances the storytelling quite nicely. The onstage band, including composer Michael Smith, sounded excellent. Each veteran folk performer moved onto the stage to sing with the three principal actors. The result of this is a fluid mixture of voices, tones, and moods that propelled the story and gave the show a large cast feel despite only three actors. Cheryl Lynn Bruce as the storyteller sang wonderfully as she created and sold the main story elements. Maddie Hawkinson's vocals as the young Goethe were charmingly rich, and Andrew Keltz as Kai exuded warmth and innocence with his melodic voice. Once they add more movement, the Snow Queen will be ready to move to the next level. Broadway? Andersen's world of fantasy, myth, and dreams are nicely presented, and Smith's wickedly funny lyrics and warm songs are a joy to experience. They are the strongest elements of the show. Smith is a lyrical genius who can tell a story, comment on a mood, and develop a character smartly. He then adds arrangements and tuneful, folksy melodies to deliver terrific musical numbers that both move the story along and charm us immensely. Ravenheart, Love Letter on a Fish, and The Princess in Memory crept into your subconscious and found you later on the drive home. Truly memorable melodies. Michael Smith's score is deliciously compelling. His genius pours forth. Jason Rackley, Eric Welts, and Barbara Wertney were the puppeteers who magnificently manipulated Blair Thomas's amazing puppets. Barbara Barrow, Kat Eggleston, Linda M. Smith, Chris Walls, Anthony Shepard Stone, and Michael Smith each sounded fine as the onstage band, pulling harmonies, duets, and instrumental solos out of their musical bag of tricks. This provocative folk opera and fairy tale show is quaint and highly original. It is a must-see for those who love folk music, and it is rich fare for those who crave smart lyrics in their musicals. This is enchanting theater. Andersen's world of musical winter tales that includes frozen shards from the devil, talking animals, wooden soldiers, witches, mysterious spells, and lost children come to life in song. The magic of theater charms us all. Definitely see this show. Highly recommended. The Snow Queen, music and lyrics by Michael Smith, puppets and visual design by Blair Thomas and Company, and directed by Frank Galati at Victory Gardens Biograph Theater, located at 2433 North Lincoln Avenue in Chicago, Illinois, running through January 7th. For more information and tickets, call 773-871-3000, 773-871-3000. Thank you.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our special guest this week is Michael Smith, the Chicago folk singer and songwriter who is the lyricist and composer of a new musical, The Snow Queen. Hello, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Congratulations on a great score.
Thank you so much.
So now tell us how The Snow Queen came about.
I've always been a big Snow Queen fan since I was a little kid, since I was 7 or 8. I used to read. I think this book I had was really old. It had those kind of gilded illustrations, you know, where you could almost scrape the color off the page.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah, sure.
And I'm sure it was 19th century. And that was my favorite fairy tale when I was a kid. I read a lot of fairy tales, read myths. I used to really get into myths in general, Norse myths, it's hard to say, and Greek myths particularly. And then from that, I went to fairy tales. Isn't that interesting? Usually it's the other way around.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it is usually the other way around.
But it was my library card. When I got a library card, man, I went crazy. And I remember the first book I got was this big old Robin Hood book, and I loved Robin Hood. I was crazy about Robin Hood, and from there went to myths in general, and then started reading Hans Christian Andersen and Grimm's, you know, the standard.
Sure.
And a lot of them I found difficult to follow, but for some reason the Snow Queen was the one that I just really loved. Well, for some reason, I would say the big one was it was long. It was really long. You could read it, and it was so odd that you could forget what happened, you know, and then read it again, you know, which
yeah,
was like
true.
The Stand. You know, I loved The Stand.
Yes, I do. Book. That's one of my favorite novels of all time.
Yeah.
It's Stephen King. Right?
Yeah, and it's like The Stand, and it's also like Wizard of Oz in the sense that it's a person, excuse me, on a quest. And so there were these episodes, and it was kind of like, what's our heroine going to get involved in next? You know, it was like that chapter is, and it was just a story that I was totally involved in. I loved the ending. The ending for me was so sentimental that I would cry when I got
to the
ending.
Well, just tell us a little encapsulation of what the story's about for our listeners.
The basic premise is a little girl and her little boyfriend are separated when the little boy is kidnapped by the Snow Queen, who is kind of the personification of winter, or you could say the personification of logic and cold thinking. And she takes him up to the North Pole, where he is kind of under her spell. He's under the Snow Queen's spell, and his little girlfriend decides that she's going to go to the North Pole and rescue him. And the story is pretty much her adventures from the time you see them first very blissfully, happily playing together. They live next door to each other. And then you see him disappear on the Snow Queen's sleigh, and then you follow her adventures up to the North Pole.
They certainly play out beautifully. And I refer to the show as a chamber folk operetta.
Great. I'll go for that.
Because
I like Gilbert and Sullivan,
through.
And I like Sigmund Romberg, and you know that. Yeah, the more singing that I can get into a situation, I think the happier I am.
So tell us now how you got Blair Thomas and those magnificent puppets involved, and the visual, the backdrop visual really works. And Frank Galati. I mean, you talk about the A-list team.
Yeah,
tell us how that happened.
Well, first, Blair was brought into this by Frank. And I was not aware of that aspect of show business in general, the whole puppetry thing, and the fact that Blair's been around for centuries, well, for a long time here in Chicago, doing very good work. I didn't know anything about that. I'm not really into theater that much. I mean, I don't know that much about it, or I'm not a frequenter of theater. And Frank and I are old friends. Frank directed The Grapes of Wrath, which was a Steppenwolf production.
Magnificent. And you did music for
I
that.
I did the music
yeah,
for
I,
that.
Yeah, I saw that.
And
was awesome.
And how that happened was he came to see me do a concert. A friend of his named Claudia Schmidt was doing a concert, and I opened for her. And he saw me play, and he got a record, and he called me up afterwards. He said, are you responsible for the arrangements on your record? And I said, oh, yeah. I tell everybody what to play. And he said, great, would you like to do The Grapes of Wrath? And I was like, oh, I had a job at the time. I had a straight job. I had given up. I had given up being a musician. Yeah, I had a straight job, and it was tedious. Lovely people, but tedious work. And I had been doing that for quite a few years because I was not good at booking myself. And so when he got me that assignment, which turned out to be essentially about a two-year relationship with Steppenwolf and with that play.
Because it moved on to New York, didn't it?
Right, yeah. And before
it won
that,
some Tony Awards?
We won the big Tony, Best Play. And Best Director, the two big Tonys. And besides that, we were in California for a bunch of months at La Jolla Playhouse, and we were also in London, England. So it was a gas. The whole thing was a gas.
Not bad for a neighborhood folk singer.
It was wonderful. It was changed my life. Changed my life. You know, got me out of the straight job because I couldn't do that anymore, you know. And so in the course of after this was running for a while, I looked around and I got a fortunate lady who was interested in booking me and has been booking me for over 10 years now. And so it was a wonderful, he saved me really from.
Did you ask Frank to get involved in this project?
Yes. Well, actually, it was Dennis who asked Frank, and
Dennis
I wasn't Ocek, even.
Dennis Ocek.
And I wasn't going to even ask Frank it because Frank had said to me, "I'd like to do a musical with you sometime." And I thought, "Oh, he's such a nice man. He's being nice to me, you know." And it wouldn't have been my tendency to go to him and say, "Would you like to do this?"
Especially when he was slightly involved with the Pirate Queen.
Yeah, and I also thought of him. He's, you know, he's doing Inherit the Wind on Broadway, and he's doing the Seussical, and he's doing Ragtime, and I think, you know, he's with the big guy. You know, and so, but my wife said, "Why don't you ask Frank?" And I went, "Oh no!" And she said, "Why don't you?" And I asked, the first person I asked was Peter Glaser, who was a fellow who directed Woody Guthrie's American Song, and also directed Michael, Margaret, Pat, and Kate, which is the first show I did at Victory Gardens. And Peter, bless his heart, he said, "You know, I like things that are factual. And I'm not ready to do something that's got fantasy. I just don't think I can acquit myself well. You need somebody of a different temperament." And it was so cool of him to do this, you know, and not just jump on board, you know, because it was a done deal. I mean, we knew it was going to be at Victory Gardens several years ago. And when I asked Peter, it was guaranteed work for him. It wasn't like speculation. And he said,
"That is, you know, class." A lot of directors would have grabbed it just to do the work.
Yes, exactly. And so I was, you know, he's a nice man, Peter. I love him. Peter Glaser, great guy. And then when Peter, I was kind of like, Victory Gardens was saying, "Well, we've got this person, we've got that person." And Barbara said, "You know, try Frank." And I poo-pooed it. And it turned out that Dennis and Frank were old friends also. And Frank was more sincere than I thought he was about actually working with me again, which was thrilling just in itself that he was willing to do it.
Especially, you know, on the kind of schedule he's been on in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like we lucked out so good to get him. And at the same time, I'm proud that I got him because it was the music that got him. Dennis played him a tape or a CD that I'd made, and he was very happy with the CD. And that was the preliminary. And then after a while, bless his heart, Frank, he didn't care for the music. And we went through a little thing where he would go, "You know, you're not doing it for me the way I expect you to, and I need you to fix things." And
that's interesting.
Yeah, it was a traumatic time.
It's not like you wrote two songs in your life. I mean, you're one of the most prolific songwriters.
I write a lot, yeah. But nonetheless, I thought, well, what I said to him was, "Well, you know, maybe we have reached the perimeter of my talent here. You know, maybe what I've done for you is the best I can do." And he said, no, I know you can do better than this." And no advice. Not get rid of these tunes and keep these. Nothing, just, "I need it to be better than it is." So I went home with that piece of information, and I did something that was so educational for me, which was I looked at those songs song by song, and I said, "Which one of these would I rather die than lose?"
Interesting.
"And which one of these is it fair to poke a hole in?" And then I separated them. And I kept the ones that I was sure that there was nothing wrong with them because I loved them completely. And I took the ones I had my little doubts about, and I messed with those. And I brought them back to him, and he said, "Great."
Well, that begs one of the questions that I always like to ask of creative people, particularly those who write lyrics and music, and especially for a play. In what order? Do the lyrics come first? Does it come from the story? Is the music, do you hear this part of the show and the music begs for these lyrics? Tell us how that process works.
I would say, for me at least, first off, this was a unique situation. Each time I do a musical, I've done three or four. Each of them is a unique situation in this. I have to find the thing that I love about the thing I'm working on. Okay, and if I understand the thing that I love about the thing that I'm working on, then I can express it. Okay, so like if there's a scene, like let's say the scene that where the lady is giving the heroine a fish to take on her journey with her.
Tell us about that song.
Okay. The fish has writing on it. And that's, I mean, I didn't make any of this stuff up. This is in the story. He says, Hans Christian Andersen says, up there, people often write on fish. And then they'll send the fish like a letter, and then the other person reads the fish, and then they'll eat it. Okay, so that's like a way of not wasting anything. Okay, so that's the premise. And that's all he gives you. Okay. And I sat with that and I thought, well, I know that people who know me are going to say, what are you going to do with that fish thing? Okay. And then I thought, how will I answer them? I'll answer them this way. And that's what happened every time. I would get to something
That song, let me add a note to it. That is one of the more clever, one of the funniest songs. You had everybody... It creeps up on you. You don't start laughing right away until all of a sudden you see where you're going with it, the irony and the wit of the song.
Oh, great, thanks.
And a couple of my colleague reviewers have said it reminded them of a Stephen Sondheim song.
Great.
How's that for a compliment?
Oh, I'm thrilled. Yeah. I'm thrilled. I'm a big fan of Stephen. I mean, I'm a big fan of anybody who can cope with making a musical happen. My God.
Yes.
You know, this is their first musical I've ever written. I've written reviews or... I would say reviews, by and large.
Well, how did you determine at what point did a scene need to sing?
The scenes are very clearly delineated in the book or in the story. And a lot of the scenes, as they were clearly delineated, I did songs for. There are 10 songs that you don't hear, let's say, at least in my construction of this work. And I would make up songs for every time I came across a paragraph that was beautiful or that had charm to it or had some kind of thing that reached out to me, I'd set it. You know, I would just set it. I would either literally go right for the page and set that page to music, or I would extrapolate something from it. For instance, in the story, there's a little refrain that the children sing at various points in the story, or they recite, and it's translated different ways in different editions of the Snow Queen, because God knows there's been, you know, 150 worldwide, and certainly 10 or 15 editions in English alone, which are separate translators. There's a point at which they sing something along the lines of, the gist of is, if you go to a rose garden, you will see the Christ child. In the beauty of a rose garden is also the beauty of the Christ child. It's a very Christian story. And everybody was Christian when Hans wrote that story.
Yeah,
everybody, you know, it wasn't like it was a controversial thing or heavy. He wasn't trying to, pontificate. He was simply reflecting us. And so I thought the roses and the Christ child, okay, that's an interesting thing, but... The way the poetry would be in most of the translations, it was very pedestrian. It was like a poem from 1890. You know, they had to rhyme. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They had to go, ba-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da. It was like that, you know. And a lot of poetry from the, you know, 19th century is like that. Even they'll translate Chinese poetry, and they'll still go, da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, you know, and it's like tedious. So what I thought was, I'm going to write my own little hymn, as it were, you know. And that turned out to be, the song was I Dreamed of Blood Red Roses, which is towards the end of the thing, and in a way, I did what I did with Grapes of Wrath was quite similar. It was like, if you're going to have a song here, what's the kind of song that you can write that no one else can? That's really where
and
I'm
that's
coming
what
from.
You have done with 22 songs.
Yeah,
and I said in my review that I thought It's definitively a folk show.
Yeah.
But you also had a little bit of tint of popular rock. You had some real country and western sounds. You even had a polka.
Well, it's folk music is like that. I mean, folk music is very broad categorization for music that doesn't sort of fit anyplace else, in my opinion. You know, okay. This is the way it's been. Folk music performers have been, for the last 50 years, kind of cabaret. You know, because real folk music is not, how do I put it, entertainment is not necessarily its value when presented to people like us. You know, it's, I love real folk music, and it's because of the music. A lot of people, when folk music was the craze, they liked it because it was entertaining. That's a different plane.
Right, I liked it because of the storytelling element.
Yes, that's what I would characterize
as. It's the people's music.
Yeah, but that for me, I would characterize as that's entertaining. But for me, why I like it is because of the scales they use. You know, I'm getting at, and the nature of the way they express themselves. It's very bare. You know, Mr. Dylan is a perfect example of what happens when a person who is a folk singer at heart starts to write songs. And Mr. Dylan is my hero. I mean, if there's ever, maybe Lennon and McCartney, but Dylan has really, the way he does things is extraordinary. And what he does is he proceeds from the sensibility of a folk singer and begins to write without trying to get too far from where he belongs. And he does it better than I do it, in my opinion.
Have you ever worked with him?
No, and I've only seen him from afar, you know. But I just can't tell you. He's divine as far as I'm concerned. I mean, we're so lucky to have this man in this century, you know.
Well, back to a little more information about the Snow Queen now.
Sure.
The integration of the puppetry and the visuals, the backdrop.
Yeah.
How did that work? And did you cater any of your songs to fit all that?
No, bless me. Those people, what they did was they simply came in and said, what is this lyric? Okay, we'll give you a visual. Or what's this reference? Okay, we'll give you a visual. And they didn't, clear it with me. It wasn't like I was giving them the A-OK on things. Mm-hmm. It was more they reacted to what they heard from the CDs that I had made.
So you didn't plan on the raven sitting on your head when you sang the raven?
No, I had no idea. Isn't that nice?
That's that so was cute.
It's so much fun. And no, all these things are Blair's notions.
Okay.
Blair came in and
the other thing I liked is the music, the top talent of the musical group you had on stage. And I love the idea of them leaving their keyboard or their space and coming out and becoming part of the show and singing a song, whether it was doing harmonies or doing a solo.
Yeah, me too. And all those people are all friends of mine. And they're people I know and love, and I've worked with them
for
years.
Well, one of them's your wife, isn't it?
One of them's my wife. But we've worked together I've worked with my wife off and on for 30 years, and with the drummer for 15, with the lady who is the other keyboard player for another 15, I would say.
And they're all such terrific singers, and they sold the song so well in character, too. I mean, that's musical comedy acting.
Yeah, what I'm proud of is that I gave them songs they could use, and I got for Victory Gardens personnel who would take care of business. And I knew they'd take care of business because I'd seen them, each of them, for years and years and years and seen what they could do.
Well, they're all kind of the local folk legends. They're all Old Town School of Folk Music instructors. And
yep. There's three people from the Old Town School.
So you could make an argument that the Snow Queen, besides being a great piece of theater, is also one heck of an original folk show, just folk music show.
It's a folk music show, and I would say some of the fact that Snow Queen exists at all is partially due to the Old Town School, because the Old Town School keeps us working. I've been there a bunch of times teaching songwriting. I've taught guitar classes there. My wife's been teaching there for the last 15, 17 years. Chris has been teaching there on a regular basis for the last 10 years Chris Waltz, who was the guitar and mandolin. And
he was awesome. Didn't he play Woody Guthrie?
Yep.
That's
where we first saw him. And that was a Peter Glazer-directed show at Northlight around 1992 or so, somewhere around there. And then I worked with Peter when he did Michael, Margaret, Pat, and Kate. And I knew Chris from then on. I was very impressed with Chris when I saw him in Woody Guthrie's American Song.
All of them. And the actors in the show, the three players are terrific.
And I got to say also, Cheryl Lynn Bruce was Frank's notion. She's the storyteller. Cheryl Lynn, I'd worked with. She'd been in Grapes, and I knew she was really good. I knew she would take care of business. And Andrew Keltz and Maddie Hawkinson, who are the boy and girl, Kai and Gerda, we auditioned those, and I'm very proud of the fact that I picked those people because I think they are so good. Both of them, I just feel very fortunate to have.
He's only a sophomore in college, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, is he going to be? And Maddie, we've seen in a lot of things.
She's worked a lot of
Victory Garden. I didn't know she could sing like that. She had a terrific voice.
She's a wonderful actress.
She
opened up her mouth, and I was like, oh. I was so thrilled that she would sing my tunes.
What's the plans for the show?
I have no plans. I'd like to do these 30 shows or the 40 shows we're doing and try to get it so that we're really ripping through those tunes. You know, this is very exciting to get to work on a thing over and over and over. And as far as plans for the show are concerned, my feeling is that's Victory Garden's province and Frank's province, you know, and I'm going to go where it'll take me.
Well, I can see this show being remounted, and I could see the show having a future, at least in regional theater.
Yeah, that's my hope.
A lot of people think that with an addition of maybe some bigger sets and some choreography, the show could head to New York.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be cool? Yeah.
So is this like your dream show?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big fucking deal for me to be doing this at this age. My God. I'm 65, and this is my first musical. I mean, this is heavy to me.
And folks, he performs on stage, and he's terrific.
Thank you. But what I'm saying here is, it's a big deal. It's a big deal to work with these people. Victory Gardens has given me home for the last 10 years. If I have a notion, I can come to them, and I feel very, very fortunate. And I feel fortunate to be living in Chicago, where theater is a happening thing, and there's a chance to go somewhere with it. I mean, I'm blessed. I am so blessed. You know, I mean, just right now, the fact that people like it, you know, and that we're getting to do it, you know, and that I'm not dead. I mean,
what else is there? What advice would you give to young composers, either folk or rock composers, who maybe never gave a thought, or in the back of their mind they have this dream about writing a musical?
Boy, I don't know. I would say about being a musician in general is... it is, you're never wasting time if you're woodshedding. And I wish that I had gotten started a lot earlier, and I wish I had been more sincerely devoted to what I now find to be a miraculous way to live, which is being a musician. It took me a long time to understand how beautiful that is. You know, I don't know, I worked at a lot of odd situations, but nonetheless, I got to say, how do I put this? When I first started wanting to be a musician, all the people around me would say, "What are you going to do to fall back on?
What's
your day job going to be?" And that's, they're presuming that you're not going to do well. And I presumed that I wasn't going to do well. And I always did it with my left hand. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I'm close to your age, and I had the same thing. We were taught you had to be practical. They didn't want us to be dreamers and creative.
And the people who were talking to us, they weren't dreamers and creators. Of course they had that attitude. You talk to a factory worker and say, you know what, hey, Dad, I'd like to go into the music business. He's like, what? You know? And there's no way you can expect from him any kind of reaction that's going to be reasonable.
So would you give the advice to the younger, who are more open to it, to go for your dream?
First off, it's not a dream. It's a practical reality. You better be educated, and you better understand what's going on, and you better make it your life's work. That is, when you get home from school, you've got free time. You're a kid. You've got free time. I mean, who has free time as an adult? You know, I had a job. I know what that's like. You go home and you want to drink. That's all you do. You lie around. You have to go to your job next day. But when you're a kid and you're in school, that's the time to do it.
To learn the craft. Learn.
Learn and grab what it is you want. Learn how to get it. It's not going to be given to you. You know, I thought I was so cool when I was 17. I thought everything was going to come to me. And it's taken me till the time I'm 60 to say, I better do some work.
Well, you know what they say. It's not how you do it, it's when you do it, and it doesn't make any difference. And all I can say is I have seen almost 300 plays this year, and this is one of the most remarkable pieces.
Thank you
and
so much.
Everybody was saying that. The buzz Monday night on the opening was amazing.
Great, great. And, that's great to hear.
We're going to see it again tonight, I'm really looking forward to this. I wish you the best.
Thank you, sir.
And I think you're going to be in award territory here. I just have that feeling.
From your mouth to God's ear. Take care now.
Thank you. This is Tom Williams thanking you for listening this week. And remember, go see a play this week.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. We would like to thank Michael Smith for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. Also, I would like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer, without whom this show would not be possible. And also, I'd like to thank you and invite you back next week. Remember, we're here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.